Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Our last conversation was with NPR's Glenn Weldon about the current and future impact of comic culture. So we thought we'd check it out how we got here. While there have been comic aficionados for decades, Marvel has become a dominating mainstream cultural force since the 2010s, with the rise of the cinematic universe, from huge Avenger blockbuster films to TV spin-offs, including Loki, WandaVision, and The Falcon and the Winter Soldier. But where did this all start? Marvel Comics. Journalist Douglas Wolk read around, wait for this, 27,000 Marvel comics dating back to 1961. As he writes in his new book, All the Marvels, these comics are the longest, continuous, self-contained work of fiction ever created, over 500,000 pages to date, and growing. Having immersed himself into what he dubbed the Mountain of Marvel, Wolk has become the perfect tour guide for those who want to get a little insight into Marvel history, and for those who are interested in taking the plunge but don't know where to start. Douglas Wolk, author of All the Marvels, joins me now. Hi, Douglas.
Here.
So I just want to ask you a couple. Who, what, where, when, whys? Who started Marvel, when, and why?
Marvel Comics started in 1939, technically. There was a company run by Martin Goodman that didn't really have a name, but it started publishing a comic that was called Marvel Comics just for its first issue. The thing that we think of as Marvel Comics, though, really started in 1961 with Jack Kirby, a writer and artist, and the writer and editor Stan Lee, and the artist Steve Ditko, and a handful of other people. It didn't really get that name until 1963, but really 1961 is pretty much where we start the clock running.
What was the first Marvel comic in 61?
That depends. So the standard way of thinking about it, it's Fantastic Four number one, Jack Kirby and Stan Lee, coming back to superheroes, because superheroes were really out of fashion by 1961. They were a 40s fad that was mostly, you know, not so much a thing anymore. In my book, All of the Marvels, I'm actually talking about how it might have started a little bit earlier with a comic called Linda Carter, Student Nurse, of all things.
Yes, tell me more.
Around 1961, as the company that would become Marvel was publishing Monster Comics mm-hmm. and Western Comics and War Comics, they were also publishing a lot of comics about young professional women and teenage girls. And Linda Carter, Student Nurse, was one of them. Hmm. It was there were all of these comics about, you know, teenage girls, Millie the Model and Patsy and Heidi. They were all sort of in the same universe, too. The characters would meet each other. They would talk to each other. They would appear in each other's comics. And that's what they did a little later on with the superhero comics that started in 61, 62. Spider-Man and the Hulk and the Avengers and all of these. But the idea behind it was a little earlier than that.
What did Marvel put out into, pardon me, the universe and the world that was different or unique?
The really special thing about Marvel's first decade of comics is that they were so artistically inventive and creative. There were so many ideas, so many fascinating characters, so many fascinating places inside them. And it was all happening in one world. You would see things that would happen in you know, the Fantastic Four comic that would have consequences in Avengers, and that would have consequences in Thor, that would have consequences in X-Men. And the idea of all of these little stories adding up to one gigantic story was really something new.
My guest is Douglas Wolk. He is an author, a journalist, and he's the author of the book All of the Marvels, subtitle, A Journey to the Ends of the Biggest Story Ever Told, which brings me to the question of somebody thinking, okay, I'm in. Let me see what I can do. Let me see if I can get involved. How do you even start? You have a whole chapter titled Where to Start or How to Enjoy Being Confused. The last part is really key. So you suggest you should be like sort of excited and enjoy the confusion. How so?
Yeah. I mean, how a lot of the fun of getting into these sorts of interlinked, gigantic comic book stories is, yeah, you're not going to understand everything at first, and that's okay. As long as you are enjoying it, as long as you are having a good time and enjoying the spectacle, it is okay to be confused and find your way out of confusion, because that leads to those, oh, I get it now, moments. And those are wonderful moments to experience no matter where you are. I mean, the story was never meant to be read from the beginning. It was never meant to be read in a specific order from A to Z. It was always meant to be a thing that you could explore and learn about it as you explore.
You are so kind to have put in your book a chapter that has a title of Frequently Asked Questions. It's actually the title is A Curse of the Weird is actually what the title of it is. Frequently Asked Question underneath that. And you start with a very seemingly straightforward question. What makes a superhero comic book good? Is that simple or is that a complicated question? I feel like it could be both.
It's a very complicated question because what makes it good is going to be specific to you as a reader. With all the Marvels, I didn't want to say, you know, these are the 100 comics that you have to read. I wanted to be a tour guide to this territory that I've explored all of and introduce people to pathways they might want to take, things they might want to explore within it. It's okay to not know everything. That's fine. What the story wants from you is not your knowledge. It's your curiosity.
And in this section, you address some of the sexualized art and potentially racially insensitive images or language, especially in the older ones. What's your counsel on those?
Yeah, I mean, it's there and you're going to have to, it is perfectly okay to say like, okay, like this is not the thing I can deal with. But comics are written and drawn by specific people. Pay attention to who is writing and who is drawing the stories that you're drawn to and that you're pushed away from, because that will give you a guide to what you're interested in more of and what you want to maybe steer away from.
So that's interesting. Don't think of it as a monolith.
Yeah, it's really not. It is one big story, but it's not a story that you have to take in all of to enjoy it. You don't even have to take in more than a little of it. Just find the part that you like, that you care about.
Now, here's a question that I didn't see in Frequently Asked Questions. If I missed it, please correct me. Was there one that was just a huge bomb?
Oh, I mean, there's been tons of bombs. The thing about comics is that they're very cheap to create and produce. And so, you know, there's stuff that they just kind of toss against the wall to see what sticks. There's wonderful stuff. There's terrible stuff. There's lots of terrible stuff. There's lots of wonderful stuff. There's lots of kind of middling in-between stuff. You know, it's 27,000 comics. It's 500,000 pages of story. It's not all going to be good, and it's not all going to be bad.
But is there one that you think doesn't quite cut the mustard?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there are plenty. But this may be Stockholm Syndrome setting in. But after a certain point, it got to where I could find something that I enjoyed in just about any comic, even the really bad ones, because even with the really bad ones, maybe even better, even more than the good ones, you could always see what was around it in the culture, what was happening at the time that was reflected in this kind of terrible, exploitative, boring little story. And that's kind of fascinating to see.
My guest is Douglas Wolk. The name of his book is All of the Marvels, A Journey to the Ends of the Biggest Story Ever Told. We had a conversation in the previous hour that touched on the recent LGBTQ characters entering the superhero world, especially of late, whether it's new characters or new interpretations of older characters or descendants of characters. And in your chapter on the X-Men, The Mutant Metaphor, you discuss how the immensely popular series became very important for comic book fans that felt othered or left out of wider fandoms. What is the mutant metaphor, and what made the X-Men this place for fans?
The X-Men are fantastic that way, because you know, they are something that is not like, quote, ordinary people. They are different. Now, is it a metaphor for race? Not really. Is it a metaphor for sexuality? No, not exactly. Is it a metaphor for disability? Kind of, but not so much. It's sort of a metaphor for all of those things and for any other kind of othering you want to think of, but it's not directly correlated with any of them. But it never refuses that reading. If you want to read yourself and your experience into the X-Men story, you can. And so readers of all kinds glommed onto it. There is a ton of queer subtext and sometimes text in X-Men stories, and that is where fans could find themselves, could find stories that were about them, even if it wasn't exactly about them.
Let's talk about Black Panther, whose origins trace back to the first run of Fantastic Four. But you note in chapter 14, what kings do, the Black Panther is not the fully fleshed out character we know today. What was his first appearance in the Marvel universe, and in what context?
So he shows up for the first time in 1966 in Fantastic Four number 52. And this is a thing that Jack Kirby and Stan Lee have been, they've been working on for a while. They've been developing this character for a while because he was the first black superhero in American comics. And he is fantastically interesting. His first appearance is kind of half a mix of, you know, deepest, darkest Africa kind of cliches and things that completely invert that. The vision of Wakanda as this technological paradise with this brilliant philosopher king who rules over it, the Black Panther, is there from the get-go. It just took a long while for other elements of that to come in. He's not even named as T'Challa until a couple of years later. And so he gradually develops over decades with lots of different writers and artists contributing to his story, building the Black Panther and building Wakanda over decades until it becomes what we know now.
In the 70s, Black Panther got its first black artist named Billy Graham. So what did Graham bring to Black Panther?
Graham was extraordinary. He had this absolutely fantastic design sense. He was the first black artist to do a substantial amount of work for Marvel. He worked on that. He also worked on their other early 70s series with a black protagonist, which was Luke Cage, Hero for Hire, which, you know, we've seen the Luke Cage TV show more recently. And in the case of both Black Panther and Luke Cage, he co-plotted those stories too. The way that Marvel stories have been made, especially in the 60s and 70s, is not top-down from a writer. It is not somebody writing a script and then an artist executing it. It is much more collaborative. It's much more driven by the artist's ideas and abilities. And Billy Graham really contributed a lot to the kind of look and feel of those early Black Panther stories. It's really gorgeous.
As I mentioned at the top, you read 27,000-plus comics. What was the what is your origin story for doing that?
I mean, my origin story for reading comics is, you know, 9-year-old Douglas Wolk picks up a green issue of Green Lantern Green Arrow at near his grandparents' place in Lake George, New York. But for reading all of these comics, my son got interested in the idea of, you know, reading all these comics because he was like, oh, this is a complicated system. I like complicated systems. He's 10 years old at the time. I thought, okay, you know, we'll read together for a week. It'll be fun. It'll be a nice week we have together. 4 months later, he'd read, you know, hundreds and hundreds of comics and was still going strong. And I started thinking, what would it be like to read all of these Marvel comics from 1961 onward? Because it really is all one big story in the same sense that the MCU is all one big story in a lot of discrete parts. But what would that 60-year-long story say? What would those 500,000 pages look like as a narrative? And what would it say about the world that produced it and that it was born into?
Is there any what would it say? Was there any sort of overarching theme that came out of this when you finished?
There are some themes like that. There are some themes about science and perfectibility and the idea of redemption and the idea of monsters as this thing you have to protect your family from. But there's also themes that change over time. If you look at the comics of the 60s, they're very much about the Cold War and the fear of what was behind the Iron Curtain, as they say. They never said, you know, Russia or China. They said behind the Iron Curtain. As it goes on, it's much more about the search for identity, the search for finding out who you are and navigating this bizarre world that keeps changing around you for technological reasons. And in the last 10 years, one theme that's come out of all these Marvel superhero comics, I'm sure unintentionally, but it's there, is the question of who controls the narrative, who controls the story, what is real news and what is fake news. That just keeps coming up, and it's fascinating to see.
The name of the book is All of the Marvels, A Journey to the Ends of the Biggest Story Ever Told. My guest has been Douglas Wolk. Douglas, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.